Good morning, everybody, and very few people will know just how much commitment, work and competence Zia has brought to the job of chairman. We would not have done on May the 1st what we did without him. My thanks go to him. Must begin today by saying that our thoughts are very much with Liverpool Football Club, their supporters, who were celebrating after an absolutely fantastic season that they'd had, and our thoughts go out to all of them after that mindless act of violence. We also thank members of the public who did all they could to help the victims and, of course, our emergency services. It was on the 3rd of June last year that I decided I would end my political retirement, give up a nice easy life, and throw myself back into the front lines of British politics. I said on that day that we would get millions of votes in the general election and establish a beachhead in Parliament, and that is exactly what we did. I have spent most of my time since July the 5th last year trying to build this party, professionalise this party, and everything was aimed at May the 1st. And around me today on this stage, you see the fruits of that labour from myself, Zia, and tens of thousands of activists out there in the country. What you see before you today is a new Member of Parliament for Runcorn, two mayors, and 9 of our 10 councils in which we have overall majority control. Reform is now in government in large swathes of England. What you see before you, whether you can yet believe it or not, is the second step of what is going to be the biggest political revolution this country has seen since the Labour Party overtook the Liberals over 100 years ago. And the big shout-out message, and it's very, very clear, is if you vote reform, you get reform. No longer will the argument be, well, we like reform, we like what they stand for, we like some of their people, but to vote for them would be a wasted vote. That is not the case anymore. In fact, in many ways, if you look at the map today, if you look at Scotland, you look at Wales, you look at the whole of the Red Wall and many other parts of England, if you want a party to be the opposition party to this Labour government, then it's a Conservative vote that would be a wasted vote. It's a Conservative vote that actually would help keep Labour in power. And that is the absolutely fundamental shift of public perception that has happened after May the 1st. Over 40% of people who voted Conservative at the last election actually wanted to vote reform, but didn't do it because they thought it would be a wasted vote. And that has been completely and utterly destroyed as an argument. Now, of course, we have a lot to do now that we're in office, and there is a heavy burden of responsibility on the shoulders of many in this room. And our DOGE unit has now been set up. You'll be hearing much more about that. We firmly established which flags we will and won't fly from Council Hall, something that is very popular with the public. And we are already beginning to discover excessive wastes of money in local government. But please don't judge us just yet. Some of these leaders were only sworn in as recently as last Friday. But we are on our way. Our membership from June the 3rd last year has gone from 28,000 to over 235,000. I have absolutely no idea how many members the Conservative Party has, or indeed, how many members the Labour Party has. The last figure we had was many months ago, and they were losing a member every 10 minutes. I'm not saying we are already the biggest political party by membership, but we must be very, very close indeed. As for the Conservatives, I don't think many in the media class yet really understand the extent to which they are dying as a political party. It's over. It is done. And frankly, after the level of betrayal that we saw, especially since the 2019 victory with the 80-seat majority, they fully deserve everything that is happening to them. And as I mentioned already, They ceased to be a national party. They are now an irrelevance in Scotland, an irrelevance in Wales, a complete irrelevance in the Red Wall, where nobody will ever trust them again. Now, of course, there's much talk about who the leader of the Conservative Party might be, and they change leaders pretty regularly. And maybe Kemi Badenoch's not having a particularly great time. Now, there is somebody who fancies his chances. He's been on his MPIC. He's running marathons. I noticed a very nice new Savile Row suit the other day. Perhaps even had his teeth done. I don't know. But it's completely irrelevant whether Robert Jenrick becomes leader of the Conservative Party or Kemi Badenoch stays on as party leader. It's completely irrelevant if Boris Johnson decided, although he's got some pretty heavy domestic duties by the looks of it, whether he decides to return. They will not be trusted again. They have no chance of winning the next general election, none whatsoever. And I don't really wish to spend much more time talking about them. They did sink to fourth in the opinion polls with YouGov last year. It is over. It is done. They've had a good 200 years. It is now finished. But today I wanted to talk a bit more, really, about the Labour Party. Now, they, of course, right now, are absolutely terrified of reform. And if you think the Conservatives had a bad day on May the 1st, arguably, Labour did even worse. We completely wiped them out in County Durham, in many other parts of the East Midlands and elsewhere. And now, I have to say, they've decided they'll turn their guns on me. And every PMQs now, we see an obscure backbench Labour MP get up and ask the Prime Minister a question. You know, is it true that the Honourable Member from Clacton is a complete rotter? To which the PM says, oh, well, of course he, you know, supports Putin and wants to abolish the NHS. And I have to sit there, and I've got no means of actually answering back or fighting back in any way at all. I think even without reform, this government is off to the worst start of any government since Eden and the Suez crisis in 1956. They are collapsing in terms of support. Their response to us is just to turn on the Labour lie machine. And I think today, perhaps it's just a little opportunity for me perhaps to answer some of that. Reform really are now the party of working people. One of the arguments I made in the run-up to May the 1st was that many of our voters are people with alarms that go off at 5 o'clock in the morning. They go off to work. They work damned hard. Whether they're working for companies, whether they're trade union members, whether they run their own businesses or act as sole traders. They're the people that are voting for us. And the great divide that is opening up in British society is between those that get up and go to work, pay an ever-increasing tax burden, feel ever more hampered by government at every level, and their next-door neighbours who choose to do nothing but actually have a very similar standard of living. That is becoming increasingly a massive problem in this country. But I also think that Labour have a problem with their personalities. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, I don't think I've ever seen anybody so hopelessly out of their depth at any point in my professional or political career. And the idea that we were going to get this 10-year Bank of England economist, and of course she was dubbed by my colleague Lee Anderson as Rachel from accounts, which actually wasn't accurate, because it's Rachel from complaints. She is doing the most awful job, and what she and the Prime Minister have done is to spread doom and gloom and despondency. Economics works on confidence. This lot haven't managed to instill any. And of course she's backed up by Jonathan Reynolds, ever affable, but not the qualified solicitor that he told everybody he was. This is a very low-grade government. And unless you have successful private business, employing people and paying taxes, you cannot have an effective, functioning society. And it is, to me, truly astonishing that of all the 25 men and women in the cabinet, not a single one has ever set up or run a private business. We have a bunch of lawyers We have a bunch of people prepared to bow down to this concept of international law, but without the economic competency to run a country. And that is why we are genuinely going in the wrong direction. We are watching the deindustrialization of Britain. Yes, of course, there are some jobs being created in wind and solar. But for every job created in that sector, there are three or four being lost in other parts of the British economy. We now have the most expensive energy prices commercially of any country in the world. And yet the net zero mania, and it isn't just Miliband, well, we know he's away with the fairies, but it's all of them are committed to this policy, just as the Conservative Party were when Boris Johnson and others led them before. I find it extraordinary also to witness the exodus. The exodus in London and in some other parts of the country is now in full flight. The number of people I know, and I'm talking about successful, hard-working, entrepreneurial people. I'm talking about people that have taken great risks in their lives, created a lot of jobs, and paid many millions, or in some cases, tens of millions in tax. They are leaving. And they're leaving our country at a very, very rapid rate. It's the biggest brain drain we've had since the 1970s, and yet no one seems to have woken up to it. And there is absolutely no contradiction in saying that we are the party of workers, but also the party of entrepreneurs. The two can't survive and exist and succeed without each other. And then we come to the Prime Minister himself, and whilst I don't bear him any personal grudge, I don't think there's any malice in him at all, it's clear to me this man doesn't believe in anything. Now, it's quite extraordinary that for over a year, it was obvious that Starmer would become our Prime Minister. You would have thought there was a plan. You would have thought there was a passion for what they were doing, government, as opposed to achieving the position of being in government. And yet, as he stood outside 10 Downing Street, mid-morning on July the 5th, to give his acceptance and victory speech, in the 9 minutes for which he spoke, he referred to his notes 158 times. Once every 2 seconds, the new Prime Minister had to refer to his notes, scripted to the nth degree, clearly without any great feeling, meaning, or passion for the job that was ahead. And now we see that lack of any real political thought with the daily veering off left and right with speeches and statements that he makes. Terrified of what reform is doing to the Labour vote, he tries to ape us in policy. The problem is, when he does, nobody actually believes him, given his own record. And of course, the more that he does that, the more that he opens up the splits on the left, where we see the Greens, who now would tax, I think, anybody in the country on a good income, virtually out of existence. But their support, they are picking up much of that left-wing support, and their support at 10-11% in the national polls is rock solid. We then, of course, have the pro-Gaza vote, which, as a direct result of government policy from both parties, sees many of our inner cities now moving towards sectarian politics. He doesn't seem to see any of this. But if the Prime Minister believes in anything, then he believes in this concept of international law. He cares about how he's viewed on the world stage. And we've seen that in his actions over the course of the last couple of weeks. This Prime Minister has no connection with working people, no connection with what we used to call working class communities. He doesn't understand what it's like to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go out and work physically hard for the day. He doesn't seem to understand that the tax burden, the cost of living, energy bills have meant that people genuinely have had a lower standard of living quite consistently over the course of the last 10 years. He has absolutely no conception, as part of the North London set, of the genuine damage to community that has been done by mass immigration over the course of the last 25 years. And it was interesting that in his five key priorities for government, immigration, whether legal or illegal, wasn't even mentioned. And if he thinks that having a figure, a net migration figure of 431,000 in his first year in office is some kind of victory, well, I'd remind him that is a city the size of Bristol. And the fact that he's made one speech that someone wrote for him to try and counter this won't change a thing. The idea that it will smash the gangs is already reduced to a farce, as over 800 young men came into our country last week. I've done my best to urge him to declare this an emergency situation. He refuses to do so. And I find it odd that three terrorists, three men who were going to blow up the Israeli embassy, who entered this country by small boats and were picked up by the authorities a couple of weeks ago, I find it extraordinary there isn't a greater debate about the threat to our national security that is being posed in the English Channel. But if Starmer doesn't get it, and if the Conservatives don't get it, and if much of mainstream media don't get it, let me tell you something. The country does. Out there, the country does. They can see that what is happening is unfair. They can see that it's wrong. But they can also see that it is also damn dangerous. But Starmer, of course, will do nothing about it. And his second speech in Parliament as Prime Minister, where he declared his love for the European Court of Human Rights and its convention. His leadership, frankly, is dismal. It is uninspiring. It is disconnected from real life. It is, in my view, unpatriotic. And now, even opinion polling today suggesting that over half the country thinks his leadership, frankly, is pointless. Now, he has challenged me to a head-to-head debate sometime between now and the next general election. The last time this happened to me, it was Nick Clegg, when he was Deputy Prime Minister. So, I mean, I'm very, very happy, Prime Minister, to accept this invitation, but I don't really want to wait for four more years. You and your deputy and others are saying, no, it's Labour that are the party of working people, not reform. Well, why don't we test it out? I've got a great idea. Why doesn't the Prime Minister and I go to a working man's club somewhere in the Red Wall, and we'll sit there and we'll let them ask us questions and you can all come along and cover it live. So that's my open invitation to the Prime Minister. Let's go to one of the former mining communities. Let's go somewhere that Labour have held the seat pretty much consistently since 1918. Let's, whether the Prime Minister will enjoy a few beers with the lads and do the Channel 4 racing that afternoon, I'm not sure, but I'm very, very happy to do so. We built this party around three key principles, things that we think need to be fought for and defended, things that we think most people in this country hold the dearest in their hearts. And that is, of course, family, community, and country. And that is why we believe lifting the two-child cap is the right thing to do. Not because we support a benefits culture, but because we believe for lower paid workers, this actually makes having children just a little bit easier for them. It's not a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all of those problems, but it helps them. And some will tell you, well, Nigel, this is not actually a popular policy in the country. But then I've never, ever spent my time being a populist politician. I've nearly always spent my career pushing arguments that were minority opinions and trying to make them into majority opinions. I think we've lost our sense of focus of just how important family is. And I want to emphasise that this is aimed at British families. It's not aimed at those that come into the country and suddenly decide to have a lot of children. And it's the right thing to do. Now, we need to go much further. We need to go much, much further. Because one of the problems is a lot of people who want to go back to work, and it's normally women. It's men in some cases, but it's normally women. There are other huge issues around childcare. Big questions that have been raised with me. Why in our big workplaces are there not creches when there are in many other continental countries? So we want to go much, much further to encourage people to have children, to make it easier for them to have children. And that is why I also believe that having a transferable tax allowance between married people is the right thing to do. Now, I know many will say, look, marriage is outdated. Most people don't bother to get married anymore. And, you know, I'm hardly standing here in front of you as a religious priest and moralizing. I'm not sure my own track record is ever so good on this. And we all lead imperfect lives. But what is true? What is absolutely true, and the evidence is there to prove it, is that where people who are married stay together for the longest period of time, the children that grow up in those environments have the best chance of success in life. Doesn't mean you can't survive outside of those circumstances. Of course you can. But I do think having this transferable tax allowance, perhaps making marriage something that is just a little bit more important in terms of the family, I do believe that it is the right thing to do. And of course, our biggest aspiration is that working people should not start to pay tax until they earn £20,000 a year. It's a policy that is wildly popular. It is a policy that would encourage people to get off benefits and to go back to work. We also recognise those that have worked during their lives, save for a private pension, are now penalised by the withdrawal of the winter fuel allowance. If you don't have any savings, you'll still get the winter fuel allowance. So we're punishing working people at all stages of their life, and we would absolutely reverse what has happened and are taking away of the winter fuel allowance. Now, of course, you will all be lined up in your droves to say to me, how on earth can you afford all of this? How on earth can you afford 5 billion here or 5 billion there? Almost forgetting that the national debt is now 2.8 trillion and that not just the last government, but this one too, are hopelessly adrift when it comes to government borrowing. We are going to make big savings. We will stand here before you in 1 year's time and show you the excessive costs that we've taken out of local government. And at a national level, if we win the next election, we will scrap net zero, something that is costing the Exchequer an extraordinary £40 billion-plus pounds every year. There will be no more asylum hotels or houses of multiple occupancy. People who come here illegally across the channel or on the back of lorries will not be allowed to stay. We will scrap the DEI agenda, which is costing the taxpayer up to £7 billion a year throughout the public sector. And yes, we see considerable savings to be made amongst the quangos. So yes, I do accept that these proposals, especially the one of lifting to £20,000 the level at which people start paying tax, I accept that it's expensive, but I genuinely believe that we can pay for it because we're not ideologically tied to the same ideas upon which we believe the Conservative and Labour governments have gone so wrong over the course of the last few years. As for community, we are totally appalled as a party at the growth of two-tier Britain under two-tier Keir. I want to make it absolutely clear, Lucy Connolly should not be in prison. The sentence that was given to her was absolutely excessive. And while she should not have said what she said, understand there were millions of mothers at that moment in time after Southport feeling exactly the same way. We also find it appalling that there is now open discrimination in employment advertising against white British people. DEI must go. We are a party that believes in meritocracy. We're a party that does not accept that somehow there is something uniquely awful about the British people or about our past. We believe the opposite. We actually believe that the British people are the most open-minded and tolerant country, frankly, that you could find on earth. So we feel very strongly about that. We, of course, shake our heads at early prison releases. And this is an area that Sarah Poachin, our new MP, this is an area that and the failings in our judicial system that she is going to deal with. And we will, of course, end mass migration into Britain and be unafraid to talk about migrant crime. I was utterly demonised between 10 and 20 years ago for suggesting that opening the doors would lead to bad people coming into Britain. What I said was that from poor countries, we'd get their best people and their worst people. And I think if you look at the crime statistics in London and elsewhere, of the gangs that have been allowed to come in from Romania, Albania, or wherever else it may be, I do believe that I was absolutely right. And when it comes to country and a sense of what a nation is, of what national sovereignty is, of what the national interest is, this is where I do personally want to confront the Prime Minister head on. I think what we've seen over the course of the last 2 weeks is who Keir Starmer really is. He absolutely is the globalist. He absolutely is the person that bows down to this concept of international law in the face of courts that are either horrifically outdated or, frankly, wholly illegitimate. And yet, that's what he believes in. The EU reset, which starts to align us back with EU law, not just that that exists today, but that that comes in the future, that brings the European Court of Justice back into our lives, that is a total sellout and something that he promised he wouldn't do. There is much more to come out about defence. We haven't yet heard the full extent of the defence package. And yes, of course, you'll say to me, oh, well, Nigel, fishing is only 0.5% of our GDP. Well, of course it is. We've destroyed it over the course of the last 50 years. We traded away what was ours when we first joined the common market. And as I think the only MP with a vested commercial interest in fisheries, which I do, I can't even tell you what this surrender means. The leaders of the French fishing industry associations have said they can't believe their luck. They're being allowed to fish up to our six-mile line for a further 12 years. It means the death of nearly all of our inshore fishing industry. Because the old people retire, the young people won't come in. It is an absolutely horrific betrayal, and yet they seem to have no guilt about it, let alone the environmental damage that has happened since Brexit, where the French, Dutch and Danes have fished between the 6 and 12 in a way that is wholly unsustainable, and yet we've done absolutely nothing. When it comes to Chagos, I think this is the worst deal I've ever seen in my life. There was absolutely zero legal necessity to give away the sovereignty of the Chagos Islands. None whatsoever. An advisory judgment from a court that is not legitimate and that has too much Chinese influence in it. And we're paying to do it. And if inflation runs at an average of 3% for the next 99 years, it's £52 billion. It's almost unbelievable that he could have done it. And not to have even referred to the Chagossian people who've suffered terrible racism in Mauritius. Terrible racism. And now that this deal is done, they're now fleeing Mauritius and coming to our country, which they can do, of course, because they are British subjects. But I suppose to Keir Starmer, racism only comes from people without university degrees. He probably doesn't think it happens between other races. The World Health Organization, of course, he signed us up to the pandemic treaty. Everything he's done in the last 2 weeks has been against our national interest. Everything he's done in the last 2 weeks will be undone by us in government, regardless of what the consequences are. He doesn't understand what national sovereignty is. He's never, ever, ever got over the Brexit result, and he's frankly doing his bit incrementally to reverse it. Now, I came back into politics on June the 3rd last year because I believe that our country has to be turned around. I came back into politics on the 3rd of June last year because I believed I had the ability to really give momentum to this political movement. And I've lived a bit. I've had some great successes in life. I've had plenty of failures in life as well. But what I bring to this now is experience. What I bring to this now is passion. What I bring to this now is a kind of courage or madness, you can take your own pick, which perhaps you only have when you've survived a few close brushes with death and even managed to go through the snake pit on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. But the qualities that I offer are hard work, passion, and yes, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid of a mob. I'm not afraid of criticism. I'm not afraid of protest. I believe that reform represents a silent majority in Britain. I believe what you're witnessing is the beginning of a genuine political revolution, something quite remarkable that is happening and will continue to happen in British politics. And if that means I'm pitted against the Prime Minister and whoever the leader of the Conservative Party may be, well, so be it. I think I'm ready for that right now. Thank you very much indeed. Right. Okay, we have a list of 18 people who wish to ask questions, so we'll try to rattle through as best we possibly can, beginning with Natasha Clark from LBC.
Hi, Natasha Clark from LBC. Mr Farage, you say you're the party of the workers now. Why did your party vote down Labour's workers' rights package, which would have given them far more rights? And last week, Reform was accused of what critics say is a race-baiting advert for a Scottish MSP by-election by wrongly claiming that Anas Sawar would put the Pakistani community first. What's your response to that? Thank you.
For workers to have rights, they need to have jobs. And if you bring in legislation that means fewer people will be in work, what have you done for workers' rights? And I think it's all well and good making law. I saw this in the EU as well. It's all well and good making law for companies with 5,000 employees, 25,000 employees. What about companies with 3 employees? And this is the problem. The legislation never thinks about those, despite the fact in the British economy, it's the small private businesses that employ more people than the big CBI firms or whoever else it may be. And I think the idea that you could take somebody on, recognise that it's a mistake pretty quickly, and yet they could take action against you within 24 hours of being in work, probably would lead to small employers who, by the way, are already very reluctant to take anybody on, given the hikes to national insurance, given all the other problems that they face. So we opposed it because we thought it was very, very bad for employment. Now, there's a bit of a row going on in Scotland. Everyone's having a go at us, Labour, the SNP, so maybe we're getting something right. I think what I'm able to do is to show you what Mr Sawar actually said and how we've responded to it.
Where South Asian communities get to lead political parties and get to lead countries is now upon us.
So it was Anas Sawar that introduced sectarianism into Scottish politics, making it perfectly clear his priority was to a certain section of the community. All we've done is to put out the exact words spoken by him without any comment. We've said nothing, just that we will represent the people of that constituency. And the fact that they, having chosen to go down the sectarian route, choose to throw accusations back at us, says to me, Natasha, that we are winning. Thank you very much indeed. David Churchill, Daily Mail.
Thank you. Mr Farage, regardless of whether you can afford to lift the two-child benefit cap, Kemi Badenoch was on the airwaves at the weekend saying that just as a matter of principle, if people can't afford to have lots of children, then they just shouldn't have them, and it's unfair to expect taxpayers to subsidise other people having large families they can't afford. Why do you think she's wrong about that? You obviously clearly do think she's wrong about that.
We subsidise low earners in lots and lots of different ways already. All right? I understand the big point she's trying to make, but the point I'm trying to make is there are lots and lots of people, British people out there, who would like to have children but are terrified of what the cost of childcare are, terrified about how difficult this is going to be, terrified there are no workplace creches, all the things I mentioned earlier. We are trying to help young, working British people who are not on particularly big incomes to have more children. And, you know, Kemi Badenoch's view might right now be the majority instinctive view, but this is part of a bigger package and policy that we are putting together to try and make the family a more important element in British life. Thank you. Lucy White from Bloomberg. No? Done a runner?
Nope.
Yes, oh, sorry.
Hi, Lucy White from Bloomberg. On that same subject, actually, you've talked about the importance of family, but one of the main reasons that people are choosing to have smaller families or no children at all these days is because housing costs are so high. And tinkering around the edges of tax policy is probably not going to do very much to that. So can you set out what you would do to make housing more affordable?
No, you're quite right, Lucy. I accept that point. I did say that what I discussed so far today was not a silver bullet. It didn't solve all the problem. I talked about childcare. Housing, of course, also a massive problem. You know, if you increase the population by 10 million through immigration, then you need to build a new house every 2 minutes in this country just to keep up. Even if Angela Rayner's targets are met for house building, they won't even cover anything like what legal net migration, let alone illegal, will be during the 5 year, if it is that, Labour term. Housing is a massive, massive problem. Social housing is also a massive problem. I was horrified, going around the country in the run-up to May the 1st, horrified to see county councils where going to the top of the list for social housing priorities were people who'd crossed the English Channel illegally and were given indefinite leave to remain. Absolutely horrified to see that. But that is what is going on out there. All right, we need to build houses. We need to build genuinely affordable houses. It does sometimes look to me that housing developments are four-bed, detached, two-bathroom, nice garage and garden houses, and not enough houses that are genuinely affordable. It is a massive problem, but it is one that government has made significantly worse. Amy Gibbons from The Telegraph, please.
Hello, thanks very much. Nigel, you talked about making marriage more important, encouraging people to stay married for longer. So just to be clear, would you like to see the marriage rate come up and the divorce rate come down?
Oh, you know, I'm not the Pope, you know. In an ideal world, look, of course, there are valid, legitimate reasons for divorce. I've got lots of experience of this. We can talk about it later. In an ideal world, for the benefit of children growing up, I repeat the point, there is lots and lots of evidence that suggests that children growing up to maturity into adulthood in a stable family background, which doesn't have to be marriage, I accept, but more often than not is, do better in life. Don't we deserve to try to help create a framework in which young people can grow up and lead fulfilling lives? And all right, you may say, I'm aiming very high, but isn't that what we're in politics for? Isn't that the point of the whole thing? Thank you. Archie Mitchell from The Independent.
In the run-up to the local elections, reform activists set up a stall depicting Angela Rayner, Bridget Phillipson and Rachel Reeves as cows said to be sent to the abattoir. Is it misogynistic to depict female cabinet ministers as cows, and is it appropriate to suggest that they're going to be sent to the abattoir, given MPs have been killed in recent years?
Well, you've struck me there completely out of the blue. All sorts of appalling things get said and done by people fighting in elections at local and national election, and we get it done to us, and if one or two of our people do it to them, maybe they think it's funny. It probably isn't very funny. I can't pretend we're perfect, but what I can tell you is that one of the ways in which we have professionalised this party is to put people through a vetting process, and I think we've come up with a slate of elected councillors and mayors and a new MP that we can genuinely be very proud of. And if there is the odd lapse in taste, then I regret it, but it's kind of called politics. Thank you, Archie. Kitty Donaldson from iNews.
Thank you. How much do you think it'll cost to move migrants from hotels into a private accommodation? And if you don't save as much as you want to, are you happy with them to live in tents? And if I may, will you commit to the triple lock for pensioners in the next Parliament?
Okay, the triple lock for pensioners is not something we've addressed as yet. We will between now and the next election. We are, as you can see, building out our policy platform. The migrant costs, the illegal migrant costs, by the end of our five-year term will be zero. They won't be coming. They won't be coming. And we have a model for this. It's called Australia. Australia had the boats arriving, coming from Indonesia. They didn't know what to do. Then Tony Abbott, as Prime Minister, tried a few different methods. In the end, he towed them back to Indonesia. There was outrage. Outrage. The UN, the EU, the British Foreign Office. What a dreadful human being Tony Abbott is. But guess what happened? Within 2 weeks, people didn't pay the traffickers because they knew they wouldn't be allowed to stay. There is a deeper debate here, by the way. Even though the hotels are awful and very visible, if you talk to Sarah afterwards, she'll tell you that actually the houses of multiple occupancy in residential streets in some ways are even worse in terms of not just cost, but the huge social problems they bring. So look, the answer is very simple. One of our senior party members has suggested tents. I'm much more hardline than her. They won't be allowed to stay. Thank you. Let's move on to John Walker from The Express, please.
Thank you. Mr. Farage, could you expand a little on what you were saying about tax? It's one of the announcements that I don't think we were expecting. I think you mentioned a figure of £20,000. What does that mean? Are you talking about increasing the threshold, or how would that work?
Yes. Simply, the threshold has been frozen for years. You know, it was done by Jeremy Hunt. It's called fiscal drag, but that's very boring, I know. It's being maintained under Labour, and it's dragging more and more people into tax, including pensioners. There are now another million pensioners will be dragged into the tax system as a result of the fact they've got the old age pension, a small income from their private pension, and the threshold has been frozen. It's also interesting to note, if we go up the scale slightly, that from the middle late 1980s, right through until about 5 years ago, the number of people who paid top rate tax, i.e. what was 40% plus all through the major Blair years, was about 1.5 million. About 1.5 million people paid 40p or more. By the end of next year, it'll be 8 million. So what we're seeing at all levels are more and more people being dragged into tax, into higher taxes. We have to find a way. There has to be a carrot and stick approach to the sheer number of people going onto a range of full-time benefits as opposed to working. And some of it, of course, are people who are choosing that as a lifestyle option. Equally, I've met many on my doorsteps who want to go back to work, but they're trapped by the sort of 16-hour rule. That if they get a job for more than 16 hours, they lose all of their benefits. And because of a tax system, they're worse off working than they are staying on benefits. That is what we're trying to address. You know, I do accept that the 20,000 level, where the threshold would be raised to, is our greatest ambition. But I think it's something that we simply have to do. Thank you. Rachel Cunliffe from The New Statesman.
Thank you. You talk about councils, and you've got representatives from the councils that Reform are now leading on stage. For the most part, it isn't waste or DEI that's putting council budgets under strain. It's adult and child social care, which accounts for 2/3 of council budgets and is only set to get more expensive. You haven't mentioned social care yet today. I wondered if you could say something about what Reform plans are to pay for that.
Rachel, I toured the country relentlessly for 5 weeks. I visited all of these areas that we stood in. I was photographed and shook hands with well over 1,000 of our candidates, and I did so many local media interviews, it's almost not true. And of course, what I said is we can't wave a magic wand. You know, we accept that central government funding's gone down. We accept adult social care, SEND, all of these issues are massive, and it's not easy. We accept all of that. What we have said, though, is we will, where we can, and we're finding it already, cut unnecessary spending. But also what we've said is we will examine which service providers have been signed up to by county councils or unitaries, what the relationship is with those firms to some who may well be working in councils, and we will try to seek a more business-like arrangement in terms of how we provide those services. So I fully accept that the job, the weight of responsibility on the shoulders of these men and women on stage is not an easy thing, but we think we can do better. And I'll tell you what, we're certainly going to try. Thank you. We're moving through. Carl Dinnan, ITV.
Thanks very much, Nigel. You were certainly right about one thing in your speech. We do want to know how you're going to pay for the policies that you've announced today. You've mentioned a couple of pretty big measures that will bring in savings, but even those won't quite cover the cost of your already announced tax plans, like the 20,000 threshold. So what I'm wondering is, are you going to tell us today how you're going to pay for winter fuel allowance, for scrapping the two-child benefit cap, and for the new married couples allowance? Are you going to tell us how you paid for these measures that you've announced today, or have you got a magic money tree growing in your back garden?
All right, you started it. The cost of net zero to the taxpayer, figures produced by the Institute of Government, are estimated between 2025 and 2030 to cost £45 billion every single year. The cost of asylum seeker accommodation, be it hotels or be it houses of multiple occupancy, as I mentioned earlier, £4 billion every year. That may be a slightly low estimate, because actually the overall costs of illegal immigration are much higher. DEI, as researched by Defunding Political Campaigns, estimated to cost government £7 billion every year. Quangos, just a 5% cut. And by the way, do you remember in the general election, we suggested a 5% cut? I mean, you thought, you know, what dreadful people we were. Impossible, it can't be done. And yet the government now proposing a 5% cut. Well, we're proposing a 5% cut to Quango funding, which would, over a five-year term, be £65 billion. If you add all that up, you've got a pretty eye-watering number of £350 billion. And whilst that may be, I accept, you know, slightly optimistic, because it's difficult always to cut everything, I think you can see very clearly the direction that we're going in. We can't afford net zero. It's destroying the country. We can't afford DEI. It's actually preventing many talented people from succeeding. And we certainly can't afford young, undocumented males crossing the English Channel and living in five-star hotels with three square meals a day and free dental and health care. I think that gives you a pretty good indication of where savings are going to come from. Plus, whatever else we can find. And if we find it at local government level, we'll find it at national government level too. Alex Forsyth, BBC.
Mr. Farage, thank you. It might not surprise you. I just want to dig into those numbers a little bit more, because some of the things you've mentioned there, like wasteful spending and net zero, you talked about at the general election.
I know.
At that point, the Institute for Fiscal Studies said your sums don't add up. This morning, one of your own activists, Tim Montgomery, has said your sums don't add up. Isn't the reality that at this point, your numbers don't add up, and you are saying what you think people want to hear? And on a separate issue, in the wake of the Southport attacks, you were criticised for comments you made about the information the police had released. Mm. Given what happened in Liverpool yesterday, the police did release information about the arrested man. Was that the right approach?
Well, that was the same police force. That was the same police force who were negligent at the time of the Southport attacks. Utterly negligent. And what I called for was, let's know the truth. Because the vacuum that was out there on social media was being filled with all sorts of, in some cases, what turned out to be crazy conspiracy theories. No wonder there were riots. Had the truth been known, we would not have had that situation. And I was condemned by all and sundry for it, apart from by Jonathan Hall, KC, the terrorism czar, you know, who basically said, look, Nigel's right. The truth should have been told at the time of Southport. I think what we got yesterday was that Merseyside police have begun to learn some of the lessons from that, and that is a very good thing and not a bad thing. Oh, you can argue about numbers adding up. You could probably argue that at no point in the history of any form of government has anybody ever thought their numbers added up. I would point you to one thing. When Richard Tice and I launched the contract with the people in South Wales last year, we pointed out the cost of quantitative easing and the way the Bank of England was dealing with it, and we were laughed at by everybody. We said it was costing £25 to £30 billion a year. We actually got the figures a few months ago for the cost of QE last year from the Bank of England. It was £36 billion. So what we're very good at, we're good at actually putting our finger on things and pointing out problems that nobody else has even thought of. And that's because we're not from the political mainstream. We're not part of that institutionalized set of thinking. We take a fresh approach to everything. I think what I've done today, what I've tried to do today, is to give you an idea of direction of policy, of priorities, of what we think is important, of what we think it's going to cost, and how we think we're going to pay for it. And I don't think anybody at this stage, with a general election some years away, could frankly do more than that. And I believe what I presented today is credible. Thank you. We've now got Caroline Hug from Politico.
I just wanted to ask, what would Reform have done at the Brexit summit if they were in charge? And like Badenoch, are you going to commit to undoing any progress in talks?
Well, I accept we start in a bad place. And I also accept that, you know, Boris Johnson and David Frost did inherit a very bad hand of cards from Theresa May. I accept all of those things. But, you know, the argument, it'll make trade easier. Well, that was the argument for staying in. You know, what the Prime Minister is doing effectively, he's rerunning the arguments that were used in the Brexit referendum. You know, it will, for example, what he's done will make trade in agricultural produce with South Africa and the rest of the world much more difficult. What I would not have done is to have gone back to the ECJ and allowed them any jurisdiction. And what I would have done is to say, look, what you got from Frost and Johnson was you were given 4 years. 4 years for your fleets to continue to fish in British waters. That was your transition period. You're out now. And the minimum we're going to do is take back the 12-mile line with further thought about how we take back for Scotland and elsewhere the 200-mile European Economic Zone. There are a couple of things that I would have done. Fraser Nelson from The Times, but also I think is doing a documentary on Reform. Is that right, Fraser?
It is, yeah. You were introduced to us today as the next Prime Minister. Do you think it's true? Could you really go from having a handful of MPs and no shadow cabinet to number 10 at the next election?
History would suggest the answer to your question is no. Circumstances would suggest the answer is yes. Something extraordinary is happening. The collapse of confidence, in two political parties that are pretty much merged. You know, both wanting to go down the net zero route regardless of consequences and costs. Both running effectively open border policies. Both incapable of dealing with illegal immigration. Both who have no comprehension of the 5.5 million men and women out there running their own businesses or acting as sole traders. Both, despite what they say, overseeing an ever-rising tax burden. Both, started by Jeremy Hunt, remember, both contributing to an exodus, not just of non-doms and the super rich, but of the 30-something entrepreneurs who are now being tempted away by Lisbon, by Athens, by Milano, by Dubai. And yeah, I think the public have frankly had enough of both of them. I think the Westminster priorities have been hopelessly out of kilter with where most of the country really is. And I think, you know, what I've said today is that actually this Prime Minister is maybe even more out of touch than some of the previous Conservative Prime Ministers. They want something different. They want a politics that is unafraid to stand up and say what it is. They want a kind of leadership that is based not on following short-term trends, not on being afraid of being criticised, but has actually got some sort of conviction and, I hope, some sort of courage. And I think I'm surrounded by people who've got courage. I'm surrounded by people who put their heads up over the parapet and decided something needs to change. But also, there is an optimism about what we do. Our voters aren't just sticking two fingers up to the establishment. They've got good reason to. They're not. Our voters, when you meet them, are wildly enthusiastic. They think we are going to turn this country around. Thank you. Right, I've got a couple more to go through. Chris Smith from The Times.
Thank you. Just back on spending, your argument seems to be you've got some areas you want to look at. You don't have the details yet, but you'll get to that by the next election and basically ask the voters to trust you on that. But as you say, you're a party of government now. How do you hope that approach is going to work out any better for you than it did for Liz Truss? And on a related point, can I ask you a question? I should ask Keir Starmer, Labour's manifesto launched last year, when he was saying he wouldn't need to put up taxes at all, and which he didn't answer. Say you don't find these savings that you hope for, you know, what is your instinct about a plan B? Is it to junk some of these costly spending commitments you've made today? Is it to put up taxes, or is it more borrowing?
With respect, Chris, we are some way out from this yet, but we will be having this conversation, I'm sure. Liz Truss's dramatic failure was not to propose any cuts in spending. It's all well and good cutting taxes, but you know, she had to make the corresponding cuts with Kwasi Kwarteng in spending. Didn't do it, just try to say, well, we won't increase by the rate of inflation over the course of the next few years. That was a fatal error. As for Starmer's promises, look, I just think there are two types of people in politics. Those who want to be something, those who want to do something. For him, it was about becoming Prime Minister. For me, it's about turning this country around. Simple as that. James Hill, Spectator.
Thanks, Nigel. You went through various members of the Cabinet today. You dismissed Johnny Reynolds, Rachel Reeves, Ed Miliband. There's one member of the Cabinet who you didn't address, Angela Rayner, and there's some speculation in recent days that she might fare better against reform at the next election. You faced off against her at last year's general election on the BBC. Just tell us your thoughts on her and whether she stands a better chance than Keir Starmer come the next election.
Well, at least she's real. I mean, none of the rest are. I don't think she's lied on her CV. Not sure she's got a CV. You know, I mean, she is who she is. What we have learned, I think, over the course of the last week is that her ideas on tax, on saving, are even more radical than those of Rachel Reeves. And she tends on economics, certainly economics, to be way, way out on the left. And number one, that is not a majority opinion by any means in the country, nor will it become one. And it's a very busy space. You've got the Lib Dems heading into some of that territory, the Greens very firmly in that territory, and indeed, from what I can see of the Gaza independents, they're pretty much of that view as well. So, look, you know, maybe she'll become the leader. I don't know. Are we worried about it? Not at all. Two more questions. Adam Cherry, GB News.
Just on the detail of what you're announcing today, are you scrapping the benefit cap entirely, or are you introducing a new cap of three or four children? And then on the shared family tax allowance, are you putting a figure on that today, or is it just sort of in principle?
Yeah, it'll be up to a £5,000 transferable allowance, all right, which would help, say one of the parents wanted to spend a bit more time at home in the first 18 months, 2 years of a child's life, those allowances could be transferred. It would give people more options and greater flexibility. We're not putting a cap on the number of children. I want to re-emphasise this is not for people to arrive in Britain from overseas and have lots and lots of kids. It's designed to help hard-working, though slightly low-paid, British workers. Final question. Last and by no means least, Kieran Stacey, Guardian.
Thank you very much. You've spoken today about some of your policies that are designed to be family-focused. Can I ask about another similar issue? I've heard you talk about your desire to open up a debate on stricter restrictions on abortion. Can I ask your view? Do you think that the abortion time limit should come down? Do you think there should be larger buffer zones around abortion clinics? What do you think about this issue?
Look, I think all of these things, like assisted dying debate, which is going to come back again on June the 13th, I think issues around this, issues around abortion, I genuinely believe these are issues of personal conscience. I am pro-choice, but I think it's ludicrous, utterly ludicrous, that we can allow abortion up to 24 weeks, and yet if a child is born prematurely at 22 weeks, your local hospital will move heaven and earth and probably succeed in that child surviving and going on and living a normal life. So I believe there is an inconsistency in the law. I believe it's totally out of date, but I do believe, I wouldn't particularly want anyone around me to agree with that or disagree with that. I'd leave it up to them. I think our current situation on this is irrational. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.